Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking the world of insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Always great to have Phil with us. He comes by about once a month or so, and here he is again today. So if you have a question about an insect, maybe it's just one that's kind of bugging you, or maybe just a general question about a particular insect, maybe one that you might have seen and wonder about it, give us a call. The number's 1-800-642-1234. I see all of our lines are filled already, but there's also an email. That address is talk@wpr.org. Phil, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Nice to be back.
What kinds of questions are you getting these days over at the diagnostic lab?
Well, everything's about 2 weeks early as far as plant critters. So the ants are doing well. Gypsy moth egg masses were hatching last week in Madison.
People are
seeing tent caterpillars out. And so things are starting to pick up, and it's going to be interesting. I don't like to make predictions, but last year was a really very quiet year. So the laws of probability would suggest that insects are going to have a better year. So.
Chris in Wausau has a comment for you. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Hello to Larry and Phil. I've been a fan for years. In fact, a number of years ago, my son's 25 now, he was a first grader, and he was buggy. And I was listening to your program, and Phil, you said, anytime you'd like, come on down to the entomology lab and visit us. So we packed up the kids, we came down, and it was all closed up. We were looking at the stuff outside after quite a time in Madison. And finally I said, well, let's just knock on the door. So we knocked on the door, and Steve answered the door.
Mm-hmm.
And so after he said, well, you know, you can't just visit. You know, why are you here? And I said, well, Phil said we could come down and visit. So he invited us in, and our son, to make a long story short, is he graduated from the University of Wisconsin with a triple major, one in entomology, and he's now in Irvine, California, doing his PhD, and he's doing malaria studies.
Oh.
I just wanted to thank you, and it was all because of your program.
Oh, that's a great story, Chris. Thank you so much. Phil, that's got to make you feel good.
Oh, definitely. I was lucky enough. I didn't have designs to become an entomologist when I went to the university, and was lucky enough to take a course from Dr. Robert Dick, and this got me so fired up. And right now, we're lucky enough, Dr. Dan Young in our department teaches our intro course, and I know our number of majors has doubled since Dan has taken over, just because he's so enthusiastic. And it's just fun to see people who get to kind of chase their passion. So.
Yeah, I think it was the hissing cockroaches.
Well, I'll tell Steve that. He'll appreciate that.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you very much for calling. What a great way to start the program. Oh, boy. Thanks again, Chris. Tom in River Falls, we go to you next. Hi, Tom.
Well, I love your show, and I loved having Phil on, but we're going from a love of insects to the opposite.
Okay.
So I live on the water, and it is mayfly time again, and I've lived with them for 20 years, and I understand they feed a lot of critters, and their lifespan is short, but I'm wondering if there's anything that we can do to reduce their number around the house or maybe to discourage them.
Yeah, color-wise, nothing. I mean, I tease about this, but the only thing that's good is a good wind that's strong enough that they can't fly again. So if you can rent one of those portable hurricane machines, but there's just nothing. I mean, you can't do anything about them in the water, of course, because it's too fragile an environment. And, you know, if you put a contact insecticide in your tree trunks and whatnot, you kill them just a little bit faster, but that doesn't make much of a difference. So unfortunately, I don't really have a good answer for that one.
Okay, I'll call my mother-in-law.
All right, take care, Tom. Thanks for calling. Hurricane wind machine. That sounds like actually, when it comes to mosquitoes, when we're outside in the summer, as we're on the lake, we'll often put a couple of fans on outside, and that seems to do as much as anything to keep mosquitoes away.
Oh, definitely. Most of those things are such weak flyers, and so they take advantage when the wind speeds below 10 miles an hour. So if you can get the wind speed back up there with a fan, it really makes a big difference.
Let's turn to Jason in Door County next. Hi, Jason.
Hi, how are you doing?
Great. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks for having this program. Thanks, Phil, for the radio. I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the spruce gall adelgid and also the And my answer off the air.
Hold on a second. Jason, we didn't hear the
The Zimmerman pine moth.
Okay.
And I'll take my answer off the air.
Okay, thanks.
I mean, I like to refer to the spruce gall adelgid as a spruce gall aphid just because it's an aphid relative and it people probably can identify with it a little bit better. There's really a number of different species, and what happens is what is called the stem mother overwinters in the bud. And when the plant starts to grow, she starts to feed and lay her eggs. And what develops is this little green pineapple-like growth right on the twig. Eventually, that will brown and rupture open, and literally hundreds of little adelgids will emerge. So being a gall, it is considered a cosmetic problem, although what happens in this case is the twig past that point dies. And one of the intriguing things is you find different plants have different susceptibilities. It's kind of like a genetic predisposition. So you buy three spruce from the local nursery, you put them in, and one just gets nailed and the other two never have it. The other thing about galls is if you're going to intervene, you have to intervene before the gall starts to grow, which is, in this case, as the buds are expanding. And we may be there, but yeah. In a couple places, as I said, everything is so crazy, it might even be a little
Door
past
County,
the point.
He's in Door County.
Well, Door County, I think you're okay, because usually you guys are a little delayed because of the lake effect. So one of the options is to spray at bud break with the various landscape sprays. One of the other options, and this would have had to be done in the fall, is to use some of these systemic drenches that we put in the ground and the roots suck it up. And it has to go on in the fall because you can't get it on quick enough now. It just takes some time to get up in the plant. For small plants, one of the options is to handpick the galls when they're still green, which would be in May and first parts of June, go from there. But what I often suggest, if people have got young trees and they've got one plant that's particularly susceptible, I think the better solution is to replace it, because then you don't have the maintenance issue. But never kills a tree. Occasionally you'll see a tree that looks shabby enough that you might want it to die. But for the most part, it's more of a cosmetic problem. And if you ever get a really cold, cold winter, sometimes we see quite a bit of mortality. But, of course, we don't seem to be seeing those kinds of temperatures anymore. The Zimmerman pine moth is a critter that prefers scotch in some of the imported pines, although you will see it in white pine. She lays her eggs, and the little caterpillars burrow into the trunk. And the response of the tree then is to bleed pitch. Sometimes you see this in sapsucker injury sites. Sometimes you see it in other kinds of injury, very commonly along the whorls. And what's interesting about that moth, it's only got one generation a year. And the moth lays her eggs in August on the tree. They hatch into little tiny caterpillars that basically go dormant underneath the bark scales. Those little tiny caterpillars wake up very early in the spring. Typically, it's the 15th of April. This year, I would even probably move it ahead a week early and start to burrow into the tree. And so we've got this relatively short window to kill them.
Yeah.
And it's, normally the 15th of April, and we would treat the tree to kill them before they get in. But after that point, there's not much to be done. The trees do reasonably well with it. Year after year, if they're attacked, you'll get some constriction in the trunk area. You may get some yellowing above it. The tree will also become prone to storm damage. So I think the biggest point with that one is people are often too late. They don't think about it till May, and you're already 2 or 3 weeks past the point. As far as we used to use a product called Dursban, that's not sold in the landscape arena anymore. Permethrin is probably the most readily available product. But there are other pyrethroids, the ortho bug begones and the spectracides and whatnot contain products that will work equally as well. And as I said, just spray the trunk of the tree. Or if you've got a large scotch pine and they're just attacking one area, you just have to spray that area. As I said, what you're doing is killing the caterpillars before they get a chance to burrow in and start doing their thing.
Let's turn to Carl in Madison next. Hi, Carl.
Hi, Larry and Phil. Larry, I hope you don't mind a shameless plug for Norman Gilliland's old-time radio drama between 8 and 11 on the Ideas Network every Saturday and Sunday night. And with either of his programs, or there's a couple other stations that have old-time radio drama on at different times. And they prompted these two questions to Phil. One, I'll bet he's heard a million times. One of the plots that I've heard in at least four different programs is about some type of earwig, usually from Borneo or South America, that bores through somebody's head, and it's an ordeal of the first order. And when the whole thing is over, they find out it was a female and it laid eggs. Is there any truth to that? And then I have a second question.
No, thank goodness. And I've seen the same thing. They used to do something on Night Gallery, which is an old TV program. And so a lot of science fiction takes advantage of that. Earwigs generally live in the ground. Very interesting because they have maternal care, which is a very unusual thing for insects. And the thing about them is they hide during the day when the sun is up, and they hide in cracks and crevices and underneath your flower pots. And I think that's where some people got the idea, is that they would potentially hide in your ear. But they don't lay their eggs there. They're not damaging. They're really, they're omnivorous. They eat both plant material and insect material. And so there's a good side to it. But if you got marigolds around here, they like to eat your marigolds. So that's not so much fun. But yeah, so nothing to worry about. But they are creepy. In fact, I think they even did a Star Trek on a version of that. So it's a common science fiction theme, I think.
There's no other bug that does that either, though.
No, okay. not normally. You run cases if you've got scars and in open wounds that maggots can attack them. But as far as things burrowing in people's brains, not in the insect world.
Okay, now the other one was far more interesting, but it was just a surprise. It involved a scorpion and a bee, and supposedly scorpions are so afraid of bees that they go around defensively stinging anything that moves. And the murder victim had coronary vascular problems, and they released the bee into the room with a scorpion, and the scorpion attacked this person and killed it. Is there that kind of a relationship between bees and scorpions? And I started thinking, and I'm ashamed to admit it, scorpions, I guess, have exoskeletons, and are they really a form of insect?
No, they're a separate group of arthropods. So just like spiders are related to insects, scorpions are another separate group. Bees, no. Bees, what we would normally define as bees, are pollen collectors and nectar. What this may be a spinoff on, though, is there are things like the tarantula hawk, some predaceous wasps and like that go out and collect their prey. And, of course, the prey responds by trying to defend itself. So I would not be surprised if there is a predaceous wasp in the Southwest and whatnot that uses scorpions as part of their prey. And the scorpions would defend themselves in very close proximity. But other than that, as I said, I think they're kind of stretching with the biological truth here, which is, you know, what writers do. So
yeah.
Well, I won't plan any murders based on plots I've heard on old-time radio drama then.
All right, Carl. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Interesting questions today. Phil in Hebron, Illinois, on to you now. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, gentlemen. I'm out in the bee yard, and our bees are heading up to forage, even though it's 58 degrees, which is a good sign after the winter losses the last couple of years. My question is, Phil, we were putting some equipment out in the first week of April here in Hebron, just south of Lake Geneva, and we've had the warmest April ever in this area of the country after that date. But on that date, we were seeing mature, full-grown bumblebees coming towards our equipment. Just two or three. My question is, are those three workers, or are those going to be queens that make that new hive?
I would think they'd have to be queens to be that early. I can't think there was ever enough time for them to get through and start generating workers that quick. So they must have been overwintering queens.
And what kind of losses are your beekeepers seeing? Some of these people down here are seeing 60% overwintering losses in what we considered not that severe of a winter.
Well, I know it was interesting because Liz Meals, who works for the Wisconsin Department of Ag as the state apiarist, when I talked to Liz before we got into the winter, her projections were quite a bit of winter mortality just because she was seeing a lot of colonies that seemed to be going in pretty weak. And that's what her concern was, is that even with a mild winter, we were going to have problems. And I have not seen the official results, but I was hearing kind of the same things, as the winter losses were up. But again, I think she was kind of anticipating that, not so much because of the weather, but just because, again, the various stressors that have been causing us problems going into the winter.
Somebody told me that Day Dance yesterday up in your neck of the woods at Watertown was getting 1,200 3-pound packages, which tells me some people took some pretty good losses.
Yeah. As I said, I expect that. The other thing that's just been fun to watch, though, is I think the really resurgence in people getting into it as a hobby and keeping a couple, three colonies. And we're seeing an awful lot more interest in those kind of things. And that's fun to see.
Yeah. Real good. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling, Phil. Jim in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Sorry I don't have any sci-fi stories to talk about. But I do have a question concerning flying ants or possibly flying termites, which my cat discovered yesterday in the lower level of our home. And I've never heard of flying termites before. This was somebody told me these exist. So, mm-hmm. One, how do I tell the difference? And how do you locate the colony? Because I cannot seem to find where these flying insects are originating from. They just fly up to the window where it's nice and bright. But they appear like flying ants, but normally flying ants, I think, are later in the summertime. So I'll take my my answer off the air, okay? Thank you.
This mass emergence of wing forms is technically called a swarm. And termites do swarm in the south, but interesting enough, we rarely see swarmers up in this part of the country. And it's kind of an intriguing question. Why? As far as telling the difference, probably the easiest thing is that between the thorax and abdomen of an ant, it's pinched, and that's normal of all the ants. One of the other characteristics is an ant's antenna is elbowed, is shaped, you know, like an L shape. Whereas if you look at termites, their body is broadly joined between the abdomen and thorax, and their antennae are straight and just made up of a bunch of little bead-like segments. Now, different ants swarm at different times of the year. What this process is the kings and queens are the reproductives, and really that's the same thing with the termites. These are the reproductive termites that are supposed to fly away, find a mate from another swarming colony, and start things from scratch. Sometimes what happens, especially for colonies that are nesting indoors, is that everything is out of sync. It's warmer than it's supposed to be outside, so the ants will swarm 3 or 4 weeks early. So I honestly have been having calls about ant swarms for about 6 to 8 weeks.
Oh.
But those early ones I knew are nesting underneath the slab or next to the furnace or, you know, someplace that is unusually warm. It's still a smidgen early for outdoor ants to start swarming. I usually pick mid-May before we start seeing that. So the first thing is it does suggest, although finding a bunch of wing forms in the house always suggests a colony inside. One would think it's in the same room that you're seeing, but now the question is where it's coming from. And one of the tricks here is sometimes the swarms happen at certain times of the day. Late afternoon is quite common for some of the late summer ones, may even be, at least they start staging at night. And so it may be worth looking at different times to see what goes on. And unfortunately, you're right, they're attracted to light, so that seems to be the source. But I'd poke around and, you know, it would be helpful to know. I'm guessing they either are carpenter ants or pavement ants. Carpenter ants are usually the larger black ones. Pavement ants tend to be relatively small and more reddish cast to their bodies. Pavement ants will be very hard to find the nests, but they're probably best to treat those with baits. Carpenter ants, sometimes they just give themselves away. I mean, just their patterns, you know. In fact, one of the things I worry about with carpenter ants is they often get into window frames because they tend to get softened and weathered over time. That's the kind of wood they're looking for. So it may be a lot closer than you think to the window, but just keep observing. The best thing to do is you're the best person to make those observations and kind of pinpoint where this is and be patient. You know, a couple weeks doesn't make any difference as far as what's going on here. And what I always tell people is once you know where the nest is, that's 80% of the control, definitely.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Phil Pelletieri, our guest, as we talk insects. Larry Mueller here. Give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Let's turn to Pat in Milwaukee next. Hi, Pat.
Yes, hi. How are you guys?
Great. Thanks for calling.
Good. Thank you for taking my call. Okay, I'm really interested in, of course, fleas, because, you know, everybody has cats and dogs and get flea attacks once in a while. But the big interest to me is chewing lice because I have never heard of it. It says it on the package that you use to, you know, treat your animals every month.
Mm-hmm.
And it says it kills chewing lice also.
Well,
and
sure.
We're getting bitten by something, but we're like positive it's not fleas. We have never seen a flea in our entire lives. And, you know, but I'm just really curious about chewing lice, if you know what that is. It's not hair lice. It's something that gets on animals, I think.
Well, I mean, human lice, we have three species, and they are what are called sucking lice. They suck the blood. Most chewing lice are more commonly found on birds, and there are hundreds of different species. Although there is a couple chewing lice we find on cows, it doesn't surprise me that there are chewing lice on dogs and cats. I will tell you, in my 35 years of chasing insects, I've never seen one. So they're very, very uncommon. Sometimes the labels will talk about the broad types of things they kill. But as I said, chewing lice on dogs and cats is extremely infrequent. And as I said, when I think about it, I usually think about associations with birds. Now the bite thing, did it just start recently?
No, and this is a thing. We got a couch from somebody who had it in her garage.
Okay. How long ago did you get the couch?
That was it was like 2 years ago.
Okay, no, if anything was associated with that, you get some odd things like bird mites and whatnot that sometimes would come in on furniture, can create all kinds of havoc for a couple weeks, but they would not continue to breed and exist. And I can't think of anything, again, that I normally would associate without an animal host. So you've been having it pretty much winter and summer, the bites?
Yeah, but just very, very infrequently. Mm-hmm. And I just cannot imagine. And of course, I avoid using pesticides. That would be my last. All I do is, scrub and vacuum, and mm-hmm. it, even when they're not, just because, so curious, and you can't find information about, what a bite would look like, or...
Well, but, from the other side, I always warn people, anybody who thinks they can look at a given bite and tell you exactly what caused it, I'm real suspicious, because... we each react differently and the like. And so to me, the way I approach it is usually what the pattern is, time of year, where are the bites on your person, how frequent, because there's certain trends. I mean, the classic for fleas, for cat and dog fleas, is bites around the ankles. And usually it's multiple bites because the cat flea doesn't like the way we taste. And so they will probe and back out and probe again. And so you often get a little circle. In fact, I've heard dermatologists tease about breakfast, lunch, and dinner, but that's a common trait. So they said the patterns and all those things sometimes suggest, but that's what makes it difficult is that, and sometimes we find things that look like insect bites or not. They're allergy related and all kinds of strange occurrences. And so I wouldn't worry about the couch. I would keep my eyes open. One thing to look at, and I don't think it's this, but I've run into this enough in my career that I usually mention it when people have pets. There is a fur mite on dogs and cats that causes a dandruff-like reaction on the animal. It doesn't cause them a lot of discomfort, but fur mites, when they get the opportunity to bite people, will leave a pretty significant blistery-like bite in a lot of people. And it's kind of an on-again-off-again thing, so that's one thing to look at. Although if the dogs have been treated for fleas and the other things, usually those products are broad-spectrum enough, they take care of this kind of problem.
Yeah, and the vet's never seen a single thing mm-hmm. on the animals, ever.
No. Okay, well, then I would think the animals are probably clean. But again, the chewing lice, I just don't worry about that one. That just is something you're not going to run into. But it's worth keeping your eyes open to see if you can find any other culprits or any other patterns. And one of the things to keep in mind is sometimes there is a delay in the reaction. So sometimes what appears as a bite today was something that bit you yesterday. And so sometimes it's good to look in the last 24 hours of what you're doing, where you were, to see if that will help you out, figure out what's going on.
Good luck. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call, Pat. Thank you. We'll take some more calls. An email here from Rob in Oshkosh. When somebody called about mayflies, he says, I'm pretty sure they were not talking about mayflies, but lake flies. The lake fly hatch is in full swing on Lake Winnebago right now. They cling everywhere. Our windows are darkened by them. Last year, this time I drove from Oshkosh to Green Bay, and when I stopped, a cloud of flies lifted off. And if you could ever call a high-pitched hum as deafening, that is what it is like, indoors and out, when those lake flies get going.
Yeah, in fact, I've had a number of calls. In fact, I think even one of the newspapers is putting together a piece. And one of the experts is a colleague that was a biologist up at UW Oshkosh, Gene Drechtra. And Gene and his students worked on lake flies and the problems up there. And Gene is still active to some degree up there, even though he's retired. And so I usually, if people are looking for a good expert in the state, Gene is I think, the first place to go. I was wondering that, too, when he had talked about it, because this is... it's earlier than normal, and the hatches have been getting like they used to be. I mean, for a while there, the lake fly numbers were way down, which is quite concerning to people because it relates to the sturgeon and the whole ecology of the lake. But we do get mayflies, too. It just kind of depends where you are. I get caddisflies. There's a lot of interesting creatures that come off water that do this kind of phenomenon of mass emergence in a short period of time, relatively short-lived animals. And, you know, some of them are pretty impressive. You get into some of the caddisflies and mayflies, and we're talking beasts that are, you know, inch and a quarter in length.
I remember driving across a bridge where the lake flies had to have been 4 or 5 inches deep.
Yeah, they have a lot of problems. They, you know, thank goodness we have some of these bug lights and whatnot that are less attractive. That's helped out a bit. But they talk about bringing snow plows out to plow this stuff off, and that is a phenomenon. They still see those problems in La Crosse when they get some of the mayfly hatches off the river.
We have Lou in Kenosha up next. Lou, hello.
Oh, hi, Larry. Hi, Phil.
Thank you for calling.
You're on at a really good time. I have been finding this strange little bug in my bathroom. And that's the only room in the house I see it. It's black. It's about the size of an ant. It kind of creeps like an ant, but it is definitely not an ant. It seems to be confined to the bathroom, and there is no trail. We have looked everywhere, and we find no trail. I thought maybe they were coming out of the drain, so I've been pouring hot water and Listerine in the drain. But I have no idea what they are. They're black, and they're just about the size of a sidewalk ant, maybe just a little bit smaller and skinnier. I'm wondering if you have any ideas what would be seeking moisture only in the bathroom and usually just when the sun's out for some reason, yet I can't find a trail of any kind.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it's not an ant, I don't expect a trail.
Yeah, but I thought, you know, I can't figure out how they're getting there. They're just there of a sudden.
One of the things to look for here is, are they falling in through a vent fan or a light fixture? That maybe the source could be up in the attic and the light.
It could be the light fixture.
Yeah, see, I'm seeming, if I had to take a guess, and it is a guess, is carpet beetles are getting quite active at this time of the year, and they're small and black. And carpet beetles feed on such a variety of things, old mouse bait, and you find them in bird nests. And,
aren't they hard, though? Aren't carpet beetles kind of hard?
Well, somewhat, but they're small enough that, you know, it's not like when I think about a larger beetle that's, you know, big and crunchy. But, you know, if it keeps coming, just send some down. I mean, I mean ultimately, but I think that's what's going to be the problem, is we're going to point to a different direction. I don't think the drain's a problem because the hot water should have solved anything. And I don't see, I mean, I get drain flies and a couple other things, but we don't commonly see much coming out of our floor drains or tub drains type. The other concern is that there may be a leak behind something, and it's something associated with moisture. Where the walls might be wetter than you think, and the critters might be coming from that. But as I said, I'd be more happy if you got a good digital camera that can take a detailed enough picture so that I can work with that, or just send the specimens down.
Okay. Would I send it to you or just my local?
Either or. I mean, what happens with the local agents is if they can identify it, they'll give you the answer. If not, they'll send it down anyway.
So. Oh, okay.
All right.
Thanks, Phil.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Another ant question, somebody wondering, has trouble with ants in the house, and I've heard, this is David, that peppermint soap or oil and cinnamon and various other things chase ants away if you spray it along a baseboard and outside around windows and other places where ants may enter. Any truth to that?
Yes. You know, it's interesting. You can buy some sprays now that are just peppermint oil as a contact kill. A lot of the natural plant oils will kill insects on contact. But if you spray your table and they walk on it 20 minutes later, it won't kill them. But the interesting thing about ants, they're so sensitive to chemicals that a lot of these things are repellents.
Okay.
So mint oil and peppermint oil on a door frame will keep the ants away. The question is for how long. Once the stuff starts to break down, they'll come through. But that's the same thing that happens with our insecticides. You know, when they spray around the foundation of the house and whatnot, it's not so much that you're killing the ants. They just don't like to cross those treated barriers. And that's what's happening with these natural oils.
On to Marty in Germantown. Hi, Marty.
Hi. Phil, I'm so glad I got in touch with you. I live in a double-wide mobile home, which I bought in January, so this will be my third summer here. Both the last two, I've had wasp nests. and I have already seen wasps this year. The nests have been in different places. I've knocked them down when they've gotten cold. You know, it's gotten cold enough. I've sprayed them and knocked them down and destroyed them. But they keep coming back, and they go into different places. Is there any way I can prevent them before they nest?
Not really.
That's the wrong answer.
Yeah. The way wasps work and bumblebees work this way is they all start in the spring with queens, and they search out the kind of environment. And if they're umbrella wasps, they do it in overhangs. We've got a new species of European Polistes wasp here, which is an umbrella wasp that seems to be very good at finding little nooks and crannies underneath shutters and, you know, loose siding, and they'll create nests there. And, you know, conceivably, if you sprayed all those little nooks and crannies now when the queens were coming in, that would be a way of, quote, preventing them. It's just a question, as you say, you know, you treat where you know they were before, but are you going to find every little place? It's hard to say. I worry, you know, if you've got any kind of crawl space or opening underneath, that's a great place for them to set up housekeeping.
Space.
Yeah. And it's just, so, you know, getting after them, the earlier you get after them, the more successful you'll be, because you're basically killing the queen before she gets a chance to, you know, build the nest and do those kind of things. But, you know, with some of these wasps, they can even establish nests well into June. And so it's quite a battle. And then, of course, the way things work is that in the fall of the year, they create new queens that go fly off somewhere else, and all the remaining members that are workers die. You know, so it's always, start with a clean slate each year and build up from there. And as I said, I just don't know any way of preventing them other than sealing some of the openings. That would be a possibility, but you're not going to find
them. They build in the open.
Okay, yeah, well, and again, it just depends on the species. And same thing, as soon as you see the queen starting, either you discourage her or kill her is one of the two.
Okay, is there a spray that is particularly good for killing a wasp one by one?
Well, you know, the stuff that is sold as wasp spray is made for a quick knockdown. It's a contact kill. That works quite well. And so that probably would be as good as anything right now. Now, just one other thought, but I don't know if you want to go this direction. For overhangs, they do this for birds, too. Sometimes what they do is they use a very fine netting that they hang down. So, you know, it doesn't have so much of a visual effect, but that netting prevents them from getting access. But you worry about heavy winds blowing the netting off and whatnot. That would be the only other way I could think about discouraging them from going on to a specific overhang site and creating those little umbrella wasp nests.
There you have it.
So the first nest I found scared me because I almost put my hand on it. It was right under the railing.
Hmm. Well, that's what we're having. You know, the concern I have with this European species is just by nature, it seems to nest in places people don't think of. And the same thing, you know, with wasps and bees, too. They're most defensive when the nest is threatened. So, you know, you could be 3 feet away, and if you're not doing much, they won't bother you. But all of a sudden, you touch it, and that's when you have the opportunity of getting a lot of stings.
Yeah,
I saw the wasp just before I touched the nest.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
All right, thank you very much.
Yep, thanks for calling, Marty. Appreciate it. And we'll take some more calls. So, email here next, though. Peter in Fort Atkinson said, once in a while I would find a small insect in the bathtub that looked like a crab, complete with claws and pinchers. Never seen these anywhere else. This is when he lived in Lancaster. Is any idea what they might have been?
There is a really cute little critter we call a pseudoscorpion. And that's what it is. It has these pincer-like things. It's a very small creature. It does not have the tail with the stinger like a true scorpion, but the front end looks like a scorpion. These are, as you know, a separate group of arthropods. They're predaceous on other things, so they eat little carpet beetles and other little creatures in the house. Harmless to people. You never see lots of them. It's only a kind of an occasional one here, one there, and I'm sure it was a type of pseudoscorpion.
Tom and Stoddard, on to you now. Hi, Tom.
Good morning, Larry. Good
morning.
And I have a question about red ants. I have renters who have relatives in Tennessee, and so they're familiar with these red ants down in Tennessee, and they're about a half an inch to 2 inches long. And they have ground burrows, and the entrance to their hole to their nest in the ground is almost a dime in diameter. And they ended up putting powder insecticide at the hole and killed them, but I wasn't remembering and foresightful enough to get a sample and send it in to you. But They call them red ants, and they're a very dull, a very dark red look to them. But they said that if you get stung by these, you will end up in the hospital. No ifs, ands, or buts. They're very poisonous. Do you have any familiarity with them, and have you heard any references to them being in the city, in the state?
Well, I would even wonder if they were running into a species of fire ant, because the stings. We don't have any stinging ants up here. We have some ants that bite, which is very different. And unfortunately,
these were wasps, Phil.
Wasps. Oh, I thought you said ants.
Yeah. Did I say ants?
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Okay. Ground nesting red. No. We have some yellow jackets but the only other thing, the reds got me puzzled.
Yeah. I saw them myself before they were killed, and they're definitely a very large wasp, and they're at least twice to three times bigger than the wasps we're familiar with here.
Yeah, well, the biggest one we have here that's very scary looking but is just a really very docile are the big cicada killers. And, you know, they have a little bit of reddish legs, but they have black and yellow stripes on the abdomen, a little bit of reddish wings, too. And they become more commonplace because of the mild winters. But you see single individuals go down in the holes for those things. They show up mid-July on. Males can't sting. And the females, I have never talked to somebody who's been stung. I think you would have to capture one and basically molest it to get it to do that. But if it did sting you, if they've got enough venom in that they can paralyze a 2-inch cicada, I have a feeling it would be an impressive sting. So that's the one I can think of. But as I said, the color pattern doesn't fit. But, definitely the farther south you go, the more interesting the critters get. I mean, just is a general entomological rule. So,
okay, there you have it. Thanks, Tom. Appreciate the call. And we'll take some more calls. Just to remind you, our guest today, Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist. I'm Larry Mueller. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we will take some more calls here. You can join in at 800-642-1234 as we visit with Phil Pelletieri. Jennifer in Madison up next. Hi, Jen. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks, guys. I'm so glad to be able to talk with you this morning. I have what I think are Asian lady beetles. They look sort of like ladybugs, but they're sort of orangish brown in color with the spots on their backs. And these guys seem to come into my house at certain times of year, usually I think in the fall and then in the spring before it gets really warm. And they tend to sort of, I don't know where they're coming from, they tend to be either around the windows or in the basement. And I've been told that they can bite, and they can also, I guess, put off sort of a stinky smell.
Mm-hmm.
And other than just sort of being a nuisance, I mean, we've never been bitten by them or anything, but I have a little baby who's just going to be a year old, and she is on the floor all the time. And it's quite lovely to have your little toddler, pop up with one of these things in her little fingers. And I wanted to find some way to keep these guys out without putting down, pesticides or, trying to do some blanket coverage, which I don't know that that's what I want to do because of the chemicals.
Yeah. Sure. Okay. The issue is everything that you see came in the fall. And what they will do is work up underneath the siding and up in the attic spaces. And then when you get warm days, some wake up. And, of course, now they're just finishing waking up and hopefully leaving. And so that's really where we draw the line. And there's only two strategies, really, is one, trying to figure out what they're squeezing in. Is it a roof vent that needs screening? Is it poor design soffits? So if you're lucky enough to figure out where they're coming from, there are some physical things that could be done. If that doesn't work, sprays are an option, but I think what will be maybe more appealing to you is that the best way to spray is not to spray in the house, it's to spray outside, because that's what's happening. And the trigger is the first hard freeze sometime in October, and then a nice sunny day, south side of the house for sure, maybe the west side is where they come in, and we spray the outside structure last week of September or first week of October. With various pyrethroid sprays, which are very common now at the garden centers and the like. And the sprays have repellency to them, but they will also kill them before they get the opportunity to squeeze in. Once they squeeze in, I tell people, other than using the chop vac, don't bother because it isn't going to get you anywhere.
Right.
The biting thing is more of a fall phenomenon when you're outside. They're honestly so hungry they taste anything they're on. Once in a while, I'll get somebody that says in the winter one was crawling and biting, but most of the time they're just. It's interesting when they wake up; they're very short-lived. Most of the time, they live for a day or so and die in the house. That I think they're running out of energy. Did have a very interesting case a few years back of a nurse that called me that a mom and a child had having some serious intestinal problems. And they were doing tests, couldn't find out what it was, and she said, "Could this be associated with Asian lady beetles?" And I said, "Well, they do have, as a defense mechanism, they excrete this very strong-smelling protein. We call this reflex bleeding, and that's why the birds won't mess with them." But I said, "Boy, I just can't see how a child could get exposed enough, or the mom." She called back about 2 hours later, and the family must have made it a family project that they were going and crushing everyone they could find. They called topping them. So literally, they were doing hundreds of them in a short period of time. And it very likely could have been they absorbed enough stuff through their palms and whatnot that they got sick.
Now, when you're talking about applying these pesticides to the outside of the house, would that be something that would be done, for instance, like at the foundation? Or would that have to be sort of a...
Higher is better with this one. I would worry about my overhangs around the windows and the like. I don't worry about low because if you watch what the beetles do is they come flying in and then they land and they start crawling upwards, it seems. And that's, as I said, where I usually find in a lot of houses where the weakness is in the overhangs. Even though the vents are energy efficient, if they've got a big enough space for an insect to crawl through, he can weasel back and forth and show up. And then once they're in the attic, they come down through the light fixtures, and there's lots of opportunities. Sometimes the pattern is so distinctive, it's a giveaway. If you only see them in the bathroom and no place else in the house, then I usually think it's the vent fan doesn't have a screen or a baffle of some sort, and that's the way they're getting in. I had a person send me an email, and I've had this discussion with four or five people, where the outside venting pipe from their furnace has gotten so clogged with Asian lady beetles, it's wrecked their furnace.
Oh, my goodness.
And so these things are very adept at finding sheltered spots and the like. But as I said, I know that their behavior is such that it's always going to happen in the fall. And it's always going to happen in October, and that's what we got to stop it before it gets there.
Can I ask you really quickly? I've lived all over the country, and I have never had an issue like this, but it seems to be more common around this area. Is that true?
Really, it is common throughout the East, Midwest. It is also, there is populations in California. The only place I have not seen them is in the mountains in the Rockies. Apparently, the beetle does not do well up in higher elevations. And it's a phenomena of the last 20 years. The Asian lady beetle was not found until 1989 down in Louisiana and then kind of went crazy since then. And it does the same thing. But it depends a lot. If you're in the city and whatnot, you probably don't see many. If you've got a beautiful house in a rural area with a big southern exposure, look out. I mean, I tell people, if you've never seen it, it's like a science fiction movie. The sheer number of beetles you can see at times coming in. Their numbers have ebbed a little bit compared to what they were 15 years ago in the state, but still, you're at the right place at the right time. It's unbelievable.
Thanks so much for the wonderful, entertaining answer.
All right. Thanks, Jen.
Have a good morning.
Yep. You as well. We'll take some more calls. Bill has some gypsy moth egg masses in oaks that are higher than his house, or than his hose and sprayer can reach. Excuse me. He says, I sprayed vegetable oils on the ones I could reach at 20 to 30 feet up, but don't know what to do for the higher ones. Any suggestions on how to do those?
Boy, there really isn't. The good news is that you tend to see more of the egg masses lower in the tree, so you would assume that the densities are lighter up. But if you can't reach them, we just hope, there are both a virus disease and a fungus disease that will kick in. A little nervous about the fungus disease this year because we've been so dry in a good part of the state. And we do know the relationship of the fungus disease is a lot of spring moisture tends to make a lot of sick gypsy moths, whereas dry springs gets us in trouble. So, I'm not sure where we are at. It's a little early to call on that one. But if anything, I think rains every 4 or 5 days would not be so bad.
Mike in Pound, Wisconsin. Hello to you.
Hello, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question for Phil is regarding wood ticks. We live on a lake, and every time we go outside, both my wife and I and our dog just seem to pick up tons of wood ticks. Could you talk, Phil, a little bit about the life cycle of a wood tick, as well as is there anything we can do to reduce the number and keep them off of us? And I'll take my answer offline.
Okay.
Both the deer ticks and wood ticks have a two-year life cycle. And typically you start in the spring with the adults that are out questing. And the adults of both those ticks prefer larger mammals, so people and dogs and the like would fit. After they mate, and they only take one feeding, and of course, if you've ever seen around your dogs, these things get the size of a big bean. The female will lay up to a couple 3,000 eggs. Those will hatch into little tiny ticks that we call larvae ticks, and they're interesting because they only have three pairs of legs, where adult ticks have mm-hmm. four. The larval ticks tend to be more rodent feeders, and so they are found on mice, and you find them on birds and the like. Not much of an issue with people. They feed once, drop off. They transform in the next life stage. It's called a nymph. Feed once, drop off, and then they transform into the adult. So ticks only feed three times in that two-year life cycle, which to me is quite fascinating. Now, deer ticks tend to be a little bit more restricted in where you find them. Wood ticks, nothing surprises me. I've seen them crawling on my screen at home in the bedroom, and I live in the middle of Madison. They tend to be a little bit more urbanized, although in general, what you'd expect, longer grass, wetter, lusher areas, and lots of rodents seem to be what kicks in the most ticks. And so we find that the drier you make the environment, the more difficult it is for ticks. So mowing the lawn is a more hostile place for them to be than in longer grass. So those kind of adjustments will help. Sometimes the interface before you stop mowing and where the wood starts, by putting a very dry environment of, rocks or a sand barrier or whatnot, will lessen it. I will tell you that, if it was commonplace to see a lot of ticks in your yard, one of the options you have in the spring of the year is spray the yard once. With many of the landscape sprays, they use the insecticide 7, which is a common garden spray. They also use a product called permethrin. And we find because of this two-year life cycle, ticks don't rebound very quickly. So one spray in the spring, just when things are starting to leaf out, when it's easier to spray in the areas, or for most people, I say don't spray the lawn. Spray that 5 feet for where your lawn stops and where the wood starts, because that's where I'm expecting most of the ticks to be. Now, when you're out hiking, it's a different game. And, if you got a 10-acre property, you're not going to spray the whole 10 acres. That's not practical or realistic. So there, the clothing sprays that contain permethrin, which you usually get in the sporting goods store, the advantage of those products is although they're sold as a repellent, they're not a repellent, they kill ticks. And so if you spray your jeans and go walking, if the ticks walk on it, they will die. They don't die immediately, but they'll definitely die before they get the opportunity to burrow in and start feeding on you. And the nice thing about that is if you've got hiking pants or whatnot, you spray them. This spray will last for a matter of 2 or 3 weeks very easily. You get a very long effect out of it. So when you're in areas of a lot of ticks, and generally the spring and early summer is the biggest tick season, although do keep in mind with deer ticks is they are out and active anytime there's no snow on the ground. So the deer tick season is most of the time from any time starting from March all the way until the end of November. And you got to keep your guard up there. But as I said, deer ticks, you have to go looking for them a little bit more. Whereas wood ticks, if you're in an area, there's a lot of frequency. It's interesting that the ticks do concentrate in game trails, both in deer trails, but also where dogs walk back and forth, railroad right-of-ways or that kind of thing, hiking trails. The ticks do concentrate in there are some studies done back in the 40s that showed that there's some, we don't understand this very well, but there are odors. If you take a stick and rub it on a dog and put the stick out there, and then you have the stick that you didn't put on the dog, the ticks are all going to the one that was rubbed on the dog. They're sensing something chemically. Although we do know when you get close to them, carbon monoxide as you breathe, the heat from your body, and movement. Ticks can't see. They don't have eyes, but boy, are they sensitive to movement. And if you blow on a tick when it's sitting there, you'll see him wiggling his legs around because he's ready to latch on to something. So.
All right, Katie and Stoddard, your turn. Hi, Katie.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me on. I want to say that I look forward to the bug show every time. So.
Well, thank you.
I always go like, oh, I got to stay home and listen to this. So I like a lot of people, I'm interested in being more more self-sustaining and looking into getting chickens, and I have a big garden and things like that. And somebody handed me a book yesterday, and they had a chapter on harvesting your own insects for protein, which I just was pretty intrigued by because I'm not afraid of bugs, and I'm an I'm an adventurous eater, but I was like, wow, I don't know if Americans are really going to be able to handle that. But I didn't know, Phil, if you had any resources on there, if you ever heard anything of people actually starting to think about this.
Oh, yeah. They picked a colleague of mine, Gene DeFolliard. Started the Insect Food Newsletter. One of the things they did is look worldwide, and there are literally hundreds of species of insects that are eaten worldwide, and they're a very important protein source in some countries. They're also considered delicacies. You got to be a little careful, though, because some insects have some interesting chemicals associated with them that could honestly make you sick. And so generally, rather than going out and harvesting insects that you would find in the woods, what has often been looked at is raising things like mealworms or crickets in using those in recipes. And it gets a little tricky because the outer skin of an insect, the cuticle, is non-digestible and it's kind of crunchy. And so, you know, usually what they're using is bigger soft-bodied grubs and the like for food. So there's quite a bit of stuff. You go on the internet, I think you'll get a lot of opportunity, even recipes. But most of the stuff will be stuff you could buy at a pet store and whatnot and use it mixed in recipes to enhance the protein.
And thanks for calling. Appreciate your call, Katie. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking insects today with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, Larry Mueller here. Thank you very much for listening in. Give us a call with your questions at 800-642-1234. And let's turn to Laura in Milwaukee with a question. Hi, Laura.
Hi. I worked in retail for about 27, 28 years, and I was an inspector, and we got the bugs in on some of those loads from overseas. Most were dead, but some were still alive. One, you know, it's just creepy. I mean, the things that take hold here, that, you know, that's what I was kind of wondering about. I kept asking the manager, shouldn't we be spraying these things? And we just shake them out into the garbage, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, things have, you know, I'll tell you, things have tightened up. I mean, I do see a handful of things from overseas shipping crates and things. And you know, usually the avenue I have to go is, if I don't recognize it as a North American insect, is to get a hold of the USDA APHIS people. And then we kind of go from there. And, you know, sometimes they're interesting ones. I've had a couple cases of furniture that people have bought, and interesting insects have come out of the furniture two years after they buy it.
Yeah, we had that. They were burrowing right into the wood.
Right. And so, you know, what happens if it turns out to be a very important insect, then USDA gets involved and you know, fumigate or quarantine or those kind of things. Sometimes it turns out to insects that really just don't have the potential. You know, we don't have the right kind of trees here for them to attack, those kind of things. But it's, unfortunately, if you look at the history recently, you know, emerald ash borer probably came in that way. The Asian longhorn beetle came in that way. Sometimes I sit down and you wonder why we don't have more problems than we do with the stuff that comes in. But
One load we had dead frogs. I mean, okay. I remember that clearly.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've seen scorpions. I've seen snakes. I've seen all kinds of stuff, you know, dead snakes in televisions. And, you know, but what I'm seeing since the last 4 or 5 years is the requirements for fumigation and whatnot to bring things in has really tightened up. And so things have gotten better. Things still do slip through, but things have gotten better just for that reason, is that, you know, people have finally figured out that you just can't afford it. What's interesting now is that the recent invaders are all Asian. Well, you know, that's where our trade partners have been. If you go back 100 years ago, it was all European stuff that would come here. And so you can even find the pattern, and it's gone the other way. We have unfortunately shipped some of our headaches to other people.
Yeah.
And about the edible bugs, Boston store used to sell many years ago, because my fifth grade science teacher brought them in, chocolate-covered grasshoppers.
Yeah, well, either putting chocolate on or putting garlic seems to be the trend on making things edible.
That was a long time ago, so fifth grade was many moons ago.
Well, you know, the first caller had talked about that, about the Americans. We just have an aversion of thinking about this. But I remember Gene making the quote that, a pound of maggots has more protein than a pound of hamburger. And, you know, so where a lot of the direction of the research was going is using insects to enhance animal feed, you know, mm-hmm. to get their diets better, and that would be a way of cycling these things through. So it has been looked at, it continues to be looked at, but as I said, I think we're a long ways away from having a restaurant having a whole lot of stuff on the cuisine. So
thanks a lot for calling, Lori. Yeah, I think I'd have to probably agree with that. Appreciate your call very much.
Trinette emailed us and said, we get rid of the Asian beetles by putting a piece of tape around on them and throwing it in the garbage. So they put a little piece of tape. It eliminates picking them up by hand or getting bit, maybe, if you got something sticky.
Yeah, well, I think even the old-fashioned flypaper, you know, which, again, you're starting to see more interest in those, some of the old remedies. And yeah, having those next to a window that they're attracted to would be, you know, they do sell light traps for Asian lady beetles. And the fact is, if everything else is dark and you've got a light source, they will be attracted to it. And then what they usually have is this little sticky piece of cardboard that everything lands on, and then you take that off and put a clean one on over time. But some people, I'm sure, have seen in their homes so many thousands that they would fill this thing up. And so, as I said, I'm not big on light traps. I'm big on understanding they come in the fall. That's when you have to draw the line.
Somebody else wondered about spreading coffee grounds on the perimeter of your house to keep ants out. Is that, did that work or not?
Again, it wouldn't surprise me. The ants are slightly repelled. I'm wondering, do you have enough coffee grounds to make it thick enough and wide enough to really
right.
be an appropriate barrier? And again, what I can't answer is how long it takes before the oils and whatnot have degraded enough that it no longer is effective. I would think it's relatively short-lived.
Let's turn to Dorothy and Dousman. We lost her. Dorothy, I tell you what, call back. We'll get you back. I accidentally cut her off here, so we'll get her back on. Barb and Sainer, let's go to you. Hi, Barb. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. My son decided last year that he wanted to raise honeybees, which was fine. I used to raise them myself when I was young. Unfortunately, he got deployed this year, so Mom has to take care of the bees. However, they were very docile. They are Italian bees, and within the last month, they have become extremely aggressive. I had about 20 bites around my face and head. A couple weeks ago, my daughter's whole face was swollen up this past week. Why are they suddenly becoming so aggressive, and is there anything we can do with them besides destroying them and starting over?
Well, you know, what beekeepers will do, somebody who's kept a lot of bees, you know, this whole question about Africanized bees and killer bees, you know, they're just extremely aggressive honeybees. And you know, beekeepers
right.
will tell you that if they've had kept a bunch, once in a while you get a colony that just gets out of hand. And usually what they'll do is requeen it,
oh.
you know, is bring a new queen in that you know, is more traditional Italian gentle bee type of thing.
Okay.
Whereas they talk about, you know, the dark German bees often just were more aggressive. I mean, that just is kind of their nature. So as I said,
right.
that would be the direction of looking is looking into requeening it.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you.
All right, thank you very much for calling. Lynn in Brownsville, Minnesota, on to you now. Hi, Lynn.
Hi. Say, I'm wondering how a person could get rid of anthills.
Okay, well, the secret to getting rid of anthills is to get the queen in. Those big hills that you get out in the yard, she might be 2 or 3 feet deep. And so
right.
what I have found to be most effective is to go in with a metal rod or something similar and push 3 or 4 channels deep down into the nest as far as I can get without getting, you know, you don't have to get too aggressive. And usually that soil's pretty loose anyway. Then I'll mix up whatever insecticide I'm going to use. And usually it's just, you know, general garden or landscape sprays. But I mix it up in a pail. And you know, for a big nest, it might take a gallon of mixed product. But I drench it on, and all I'm trying to do here is get it as deep into the nest as I can. And that's what those channels help to do. That, I find, is far more successful. If you just try to pour the stuff on the surface, it never soaks deep enough. And although it may look like they're inactive for a week or two, they'll be right back at you. And so, to me, again, it's all about getting it deep. What makes it kind of frustrating is if you got a big yard with 50 nests, you got to stop
yeah.
and retreat everyone or treat one of those individually. But as I said, if you go through the effort of putting these channels in and then drenching it on with some decent volume, I think you'll have better success.
That sounds easy enough.
All right.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks for calling. Kathy in Madison wonders, when is the best time to treat magnolia scale? And is there a life cycle that you can comment on?
One generation a year is most visible in July when it almost looks like this white, fuzzy growth on the twigs. But that's not the treatment time. The treatment time for killing the very young scales is September, which is much later than most other scales that we've got here. And so, you know, when it looks like you should treat is not. And as I said, I would say the first or second week of September is the window. The other option that you've got, and this won't control them, but at least will hold them back, is you could drench on these imidacloprid, or the bear tree and shrub, the bonite tree and shrub insecticides that are made as drenches. You mix them up, put them in, and let the roots uptake it, and that will slow them down. I don't expect that to control them, but at least that will hold them down from now until you can treat them in September. Okay. Because that's the problem, is these things are feeding all season long. And, you know, the leaves get sticky. They get all covered with that black sooty mold on it. And the plants often get very stressed. And then I start worrying about winter kill problems on magnolia. So, like I said, if you can somehow remember to mark the calendar to get them in early September. And then if you want to do something now, it would be with the soil type drenches.
We have Jane on with an email here, and their house is infected with clothes moths, she said. They're everywhere in the carpet, the cat beds, under the chair cushions. I'm vacuuming constantly, but they're everywhere. I'm also getting the moths, gotten about 10 so far. I even find some that left the case and are moving on the edges of the carpet, look like tiny snakes. What do? We've ripped out our carpets in a few of the rooms and plan to do the entire house. I don't want to use sprays. You know, they have kids and animals, so...
Boy, my first take is when I get these kind of things that it's not clothes moth, it's Indian meal moth, which is a much more common and much more numerous. The thing about clothes moths is they're very restricted in their diet. They feed on animal hair, they feed on wool, silk, and the like. And if the food source is removed, they can't breed. And I don't find that there's much... And the other interesting thing is that the wool carpet that is being walked on, vacuumed out in the open, is not the breeding sites in most cases. It's stuff in storage. And the only time I've had people that have been overrun by clothes moths that are people that spin down their own yarn and have literally, you know, hundreds of skeins of yarn around. So there's just a tremendous food source. So I'd be more than happy if you catch the moths, send them down to verify who it is. Because again, if it's a different kind of moth, the food source is different, but that's what it really is about for any of these things. If you eliminate the food source, they can't breed. And as I said, by nature, I just don't see clothes moths overtake things quite that way.
On to Sue in Lake Geneva. Hi, Sue.
Hello, Larry. This is Sue calling from Lake Geneva. I have a question for Mr. Pelletieri there. I am going to be storing some woolens for a real long length of time. I looked on your website, on your pest website, and it's a wonderful place to go look for information, by the way. I found out that you have to store it and tape it with some sort of tape. Now, what kind of container can I store it in?
Well, some of these plastic containers that have nice tight-fitting lids, you know, the tape is an added precaution because the eggs are small enough and the little guys can crawl through. But, you know, normally the kind of containers that I see at the Home Depots and whatnot seem to have good enough lids. And then if you put it away clean, put the lids on, and then the added thing is put tape, there's no way you're going to have a problem.
Okay. And then do I also add mothballs for added precaution?
In my household, I suggest that we don't.
Okay.
What mothballs, you know, they have some toxicity issues to people, so I don't like the idea of breathing the stuff more than I have to. And as I said, if I put something away clean and put it in a container that they can't get to, I don't see why you need the added effect of that chemical. Now, the truth is that if you had... Mothballs are most effective in a closed environment because the gas builds up. To a toxic level, really. And so that's you know, it could be used, but as I said, I just, you know, because eventually it dissipates. And then once it dissipates, you're not getting the effect out of it anymore. So it has some limited thing. And how long it takes to dissipate, it really depends on airflow and temperature, some of those things. But either the paradichlorobenzene, what they used to sell as moth ice, PDB, or naphthalene, which is the traditional mothballs. As I said, they do have some fumigation activity. But generally, I think it's better to go with a good containers and clean clothes to begin with and not worry about it.
Okay.
All right.
And the next question is, these things are going to be used probably within two years, we're going to be using them finally.
Mm-hmm.
Where do I store them in the meantime? Should I store them up in the attic somewhere? Do I store them in the basement? Where do I store them? Considering that they're plastic containers and that they're sealed properly.
I think the basement
stuff
I like better than the attic.
The thing
about the attic is that, you know, there are other food sources for carpet beetles and clothes moths, you know, bird feathers from bird nests and whatnot. More potential for rodent issues feeding into things. So I just like the basement as I think is just a little bit safer. Plus, you're not going to get as fluctuations of temperatures, which could affect the ceiling of the covers, those kind of things.
Got it. So you're just going to have to put them up on, perhaps up on something to just keep the moisture out of it.
Off the floor.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
All right.
Thank you.
Yep. Thanks very much for calling. Good luck with your trip, by the way. Thanks, Sue. Sharon in Cuba City, your turn. Hi, Sharon.
Hello. I've been waiting for you to be on, Mr. Palateri, because I've had a problem with some worms. They're little tiny things. They're not any more than 1.5 centimeters. And they have little hairs on the bottom side with which they move, and they stand up on one end, and they come around the kitchen sink, although I find them in a few other places. What could they be?
Well, they're beetle larvae, and what I'm not sure is, are they carpet beetle larvae, or are they flower beetle larvae, or something similar? And, you know, it would help to know which it is, just because it would give us a little bit more idea of what their food is. And, you know, it definitely can't be something out on the counters, because it would be more obvious. So, you know, I'm wondering, are they crawling out from the walls because of some food source there, or something else? And as I said, the fuzziness sounds like carpet beetles, but what you describe as fuzzy and I describe as fuzzy could be different. So I'm not 100% sure it's carpet beetles.
Well, I've looked at them through the magnifying glass, and I wouldn't exactly call them fuzzy, although they could be, but they have like little hairs on the bottom side.
Yeah, but carpet beetles are kind of hairs all over the body. In fact, it's more on the top side than the bottom side. Most beetle larvae have some hairs to speak of, but it's the difference, again, of having lots of hairs on each segment or just an occasional one or two. This, again, is a case I'd be more than happy if you can get a couple of them and, you know, send them in the mail. The one caution, I have a lot of problems when people take things and put them on tape and then crush them down and put them in a letter. By the time I get them, they look like pancakes. And so it helps if you can cushion the critters in some kind of container so I can see a whole critter. But if you can bring it to the local county extension office. What county are you located in?
Lafayette.
Okay. Lafayette. Well, you can bring it into Darlington. They'll ship it up. I think if we know what it is, at least I can point you in the food source direction, because that's going to be the secret here. As I said, it can't be, there's nothing in the sink per se. It's not moisture related. I think this is going to be more related to either something that might be in the walls, or there may be a box of noodles or something you're not thinking about that could be the food source. But if it was that kind, I would think you'd start to see some adult beetles also, rather than just the larvae.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've been looking and thinking, and I can't find anything like that.
Yeah, but sometimes things are real subtle. I mean, I've had cases where none of the food products were there, but somebody had a rodent problem 5 years ago, and the darn rodent stole some of the dog food, and they put the dog food into the walls, and that's where my insects are breeding. You know, as I said, so at least if we know what the food source is, it gets us thinking what's happened in the last 2 or 3 years that might relate to this, or where the things are coming from. You know, sometimes things fall out. I even have trouble with mouse bait. You know, if people buy the decon mouse baits that are grain-based and put them in the attic or in a wall sometimes because they had a mouse problem years ago, to be darned, I can breed most of my insects, stored product insects, out of that food source because the poisons that used to kill mice don't affect insects. So it could be something that happened quite some time ago. The insects have finally found it, and they're taking advantage of it.
Yeah. Good luck, and again, take it into Darlington.
Darlington, or you can send it. My address at the insect lab is 1630. Linden, Linden Drive, Madison, and the university zip is 53706.
All right.
Well, I wanted to ask you one more question about these. We've had a lot of those little ladybug-like beetles that people have been talking about today.
Mm-hmm.
We've had an awful lot of them in the house, and I wondered if they had laid eggs, and if maybe these were
No.
They're not the larvae of that, but that would underline the possibility of carpet beetles, because carpet beetles feed on dead insects, among other things. And so if you've got dead Asian lady beetles in the walls, the carpet beetles could be breeding on that and falling through. So it very likely could be related that one problem brings another, is what it is.
Thanks for calling, Sharon. Appreciate your call. Joe in West Bend was wondering if there's an effective treatment for earwigs.
Well, I always tease, you know, sometimes, I mean, my solution is you make your backyard a sandbox. because that's an environment you will not find earwigs. If you understand, though, is the problem if you like to garden, you know, putting mulch down and watering our plants and getting lush plants is the environment that earwigs do very well in. So you have to realize that some of the things we do make the earwigs worse. As far as if they finally get to be problematic enough that they're eating your plants or they're just, you know, overrunning the inside of the house, my suggestion for earwigs, what people often don't realize is they're spending most of their time in the day down under the mulch and hiding down in things. And in order to take control, you have to put enough chemical on, and not chemical, enough water on to wash the stuff down to where the earwigs are. And so what I find, again, you'll find that most of the garden and landscape sprays have earwigs on the label. But rather than trying to put this on with a little, you know, sprayer, is to buy one of these garden hose attachments where you put it on and you're literally putting gallons of mixed dilute product on. But that's putting the kind of water volume on to soak deep enough into the mulch to do the job. And so it's all about, you know, doing it properly once and being done with it. Whereas if your option is you dust a little here, dust a little there, to be honest, you never really control them. You just kind of hold them off of the individual plants in most cases.
Shirley and Prentice, hi to you.
Hi, Larry. Thank you. My problem is grease ants. I had them about 2-3 years ago, and now they have reappeared. I didn't want to use poison, so I soaked paper towels in ammonia, which I would think would discourage them. It does me. And now they came back, and they're in an area where I had set my bottle of canola oil, so I suppose the bottle was a little greasy. That might have attracted them. Mm-hmm. But they're stubborn, and I keep seeing them. They zigzag. They crawl real fast.
Yeah, you know, we call them thief ants. We call them thief ants, but the grease ant is a very good term because they seem to like high-protein, high-fat-type foods. And most of the time, the nests are outside, and you can't find them anyway. But I think an option you might consider is that for these kind of ants, they bait quite well, as long as you get a protein-based bait. Or you can buy the old Terra ant poison, which is boric acid in honey, and just mix a little bit of canola oil or other oils, because then you're providing what they want. The concept of the bait is they pick it up, feed it to other ants, feed it to the queen, and that's how you wipe the colony out. The advantage of the baits is usually there are far less toxic products, and you can have total control of where the baits are. And when you're done with the baits, you can throw them away. I mean, you don't have to. So, as I said, you can go to the local hardware store. If you're going to buy a bait, make sure it's for protein or fat-feeding ants. That's what a grease ant would want. But as I said, one of the other tricks, the very common ant poison you'll see even at the grocery store is called taro ant poison. In fact, they have a formulation for protein-feeding ants. If you buy a sugar-based bait, you're going to have to enhance it somehow. Because if it's just sugar-based, they could care less. They don't have a sweet tooth. They wouldn't feed on the bait. And if they don't feed on it, it doesn't work.
And there you have it. Thank you very much, Shirley, for calling. In the last few 30 seconds or so, what's the status of the emerald ash borer in Wisconsin? Someone wonders.
Well, we've had no fines since the ones in Milwaukee in the late summer, early fall. The infestation over in the Vernon County area has been delineated at about 20,000 acres. The one over in up by Ozaukee County is around 9,000 acres. So, you know, these are pretty big sites. I'm holding my breath. Unfortunately, my gut tells me that we're probably going to get 2 or 3 more positive sites this, you know.
Yeah.
That's what the data would suggest. But the sites seem to be contained. You know, in the next year or two, we're going to learn a lot. Because the big thing now is how quickly do they move out of these areas? And again, what kind of strategies can we use to slow this down as much as possible?
Phil, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Nice to be here.
Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. Tomorrow we'll talk edible wild plants with Sam Thayer, author of Nature's Garden. And so we'll look forward to that. And we'll also talk about shipwrecks on Lake Michigan. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.